So they could start off by starting as a sole trader. They could operate as a partnership. They could operate as an LLP. And for tax purposes, there's absolutely no difference between an LLP and a partnership. They're taxed exactly the same. The partnership has a corporate entity. For tax purposes, they're taxed exactly the same as partners. Or they could form a limited company. So they're really the fundamental choices. I didn't say before I started, I haven't really got time to take questions, but I'm going to be staying till at least after the tea break, about 5 o'clock. So if any of you have any questions and you want to come and talk to me about it, then please do. Just need to get some numbers out of the way before we go look at the choices, because this is going to affect us. So these are the tax rates we have for 2012-13. Yep. Let's go. I quite like this sort of slide, because when you're lecturing, if you put a slide up and somebody understands it, they sort of vaguely nod and think they're uncomfortable with that. And it's good, a slide like this, most of you understand. You may not understand the next hour, but at least you can walk away safe for the knowledge. You at least understood one slide of my presentation, so that's good.
It's funny, I was at the oxymoron.
We have national insurance, which is, as John alluded to, is completely complex. And we've got the lower earnings limit and that primary threshold. We have this wonderful point here. I've got to sort of somehow or another juggle my laser with everything else. Will that work? Does that work? No, it doesn't work, does it? No, dear. We have a little butcher there. If I had a battery, it would have worked. So basically, I could point. That's an idea, look. So if you earn between 5595 and 7605, what actually happens is you, of course, get a tick in the box, don't you? This tick in the box that John mentioned they do at Newcastle, and they still do. So that you pay no national insurance, but you get the tick in the box. And that's the whole basis we're going to see in the dividend scheme. And if you're self-employed, you have to pay that Class 4 national insurance at 9%. Don't forget, Class 4 is a complete and utter national insurance. The CON doesn't stand for contributions. It just stops after CON. Actually gets you absolutely nothing. And prior to the DSS and in the revenue actually merging, they had no idea. The DSS had no idea who actually paid Class 4 NI. The Inland Revenue just simply wrote a cheque to the DSS and said, we've collected this amount of Class 4 on your behalf. Reason? The DSS didn't need to know we've collected Class 4, because it doesn't get you anything. It's effectively just a self-profits tax. That's disappointing. There's all these self-employed people in the audience, and they look so disappointed at that point. Of course, employers pay national insurance at 13.8%. Compared to corporation tax, if you're a small company, you pay small profits rates at 20% up until you've earned £300,000. The main rate of corporation tax is falling. The small profit rate's almost certain to stay where it is. The Chancellor, in his speech, said the plan hopefully will be to get the full rate of corporation tax down to 20%. This will make it the same as the small profits rate and the basic rate of income tax, which has a nice sort of feel about it. So that's the position there. If you've got a limited company, and I'm not going to prove this mathematically, you're going to have to trust me, because as Brian said, I'm a chartered accountant, so I therefore can be trusted. That wasn't a joke, that was serious. The most efficient way of taking money out is you pay yourself an amount before anybody starts paying national insurance, and then you take the balance out as dividends. I'm sure you are all been doing it. Most people have finally got on to do it. So in the P35s that you have just completed, the P35 deadline, by the way, is tomorrow. So if my first part was a bit of a shock, if you want to go now and rush back to your office to do those ones you forgot to do, the deadline is tomorrow. So what you've been doing, you should hopefully have all been doing P35 for your limited company clients with director's remuneration of 7,000. You could be very clever and do 7,072 if you really wanted, but most people have been using 7,000 this year. You can, there are some people out there who still do director's remuneration of, say, 15,000 or 20,000. And when you ask them why, they say, well, it seems better, doesn't it, than 7,000?
I don't think it
just seems a heck of a lot more expensive to me than 7,000. It actually makes no difference at all. And it does work. Our firm have been submitting, we have submitted 400 or 500 of these P35s with 7,000 as directors and directors' spouses' salaries. So You can go up to employees' NI because mathematically it is better, but it's not worth the hassle. That's the difference. And this works for every level of profitability. So it doesn't matter whether your profits are under 300,000, whether your profits are between 300 and 1.5 million, you're in the marginal rate, or whether you're over the 1.5 million, you're in the marginal, in the full rate of corporation tax. This scenario works. So let's actually put some numbers on it. Somebody with profits of 30,000. The very basic computation. So what we actually have is we have the sole trader in the company. So the sole trader earns profits of 30,000, will pay income tax, 8,100 the personal allowance. This is for 12-13, so this is the year that's going forward. 8,105. Then the balance of the tax will pay tax at 20%, and of course will pay the dreaded Class 4 national insurance. Whereas the limited company regime will pay the salary less the corporation tax, and as you can see here, it's better off by £2,011. So go back to what John said earlier when he said they've put the limit in at 77,000 turnover, where businesses may want to qualify for the cash system that John was mentioning. Well, one of the things to qualify for the cash system is you have to remain an unincorporated business. Well, if you've got a £77,000 turnover business, you probably may well be looking at a profits of around £30,000. If you're looking at £30,000, for a little bit of accruals accounting, you could save £2,011 per annum. And the reason why you're saving 2011 is, give or take, £7, it's that, isn't it? It's because on the right-hand column you're not paying any national insurance. Do you need to pay any national insurance? No, you don't, because that gets you the tick in the box. We've got Champion Comcare. So therefore, that works. So I've ignored things like car add-backs. Somebody always says, "Ignore this point." So what about car add-backs? So I know that car add-backs are not as good. We'll come to them in a minute. But if it works at 30,000, actually, and that will, it also works every number below it, but once you get low, you find things like car add-backs and fees do take that a little bit longer to actually look at. What about if your profits are 60,000? So if you're earning and you're saving 60,000 profits, what is that? What are the numbers here? Well, if you are a sole trader, you will keep £42,267. I haven't done the math. We're capable of doing that. Could you start paying higher rate tax on it?
Then you're against them.
So if you actually, just by forming a partnership, will get you £46,937. So that's good. But what about if we actually go down the limited company route? Where does that get us? Well, if you run your limited company on your own, you go up to 46,852, very close to the partnership. Of course, the main problem is if you're extracting it, you are still going to be clipping tax at the higher rates. If you're a limited company with a spouse, you're going to be keeping £50,960.
That's ridiculous.
Which means that you've actually saved £8,700 every year just by converting your limited your sole trader into a limited company. As a serious word of warning, I am, of course, only talking about tax.
Well, this evening, if you
cannot get your spouse, if you get you and be £8,000 better off, it doesn't work. Your spouse will cost you more money than you will save in tax. So do not think I'm advocating getting married as a tax. It will save you tax, but there are other consequentials. Financial and otherwise that you have to deal with. So, you know, this does carry a health warning. But from a tax perspective, as you can see, having a spouse is useful, which is not very odd. Words that don't normally go together, but... It makes no difference. Provided it's a civil partnership, when I use the word spouse, in tax, spouse equals civil partnership. It doesn't. The only time it will equal unmarried couples, that's unmarried same-sex or unmarried opposite-sex, is if you're looking at things like the High Income Child Benefit Clawback, because that's going to be based on family units, not actually. But in terms of this planning, it's actually either married or civil partnership. So if we're doing all this, why are so many people still trading as unincorporated businesses?
do a lot of their own work.
Well, one of the people might say, well, it's cheaper accountancy fees.
Does there end a year?
Oh, yes, probably it is. It is probably cheaper to do a set of sole trader accounts than a limited company. Because after all, it takes a long time to type the word LTD in your computer, doesn't it? Yeah. You log into your IRIS software, you type it up. Is this a sole trader or a limited company? You tick exactly the same box, but you did have to type LTD. And the 12 pages of notes come out exactly without you having a clue what they are, but they all come out, don't they? So it's... Yeah, but it will be. But you will charge them more for a limited company because the simple reason is you can. So nothing wrong with that. Easier administration. Well, yes, I suppose there is easier administration. You don't have to file the accounts with Companies House because that involves at least two more buttons to click. And anything, so it is easier to administer. I mean, if you ever want to, have you ever actually, have you who deal with small businesses, have you actually read the guidelines for how to be a company director issued by Companies House? I mean, that make sure you give one of those to every single client you have and say, don't you worry, I'll do all of these things for you. Because if you read what a director of a limited company is supposed to do, you'd never sleep at night. So give it to your client, let them worry, and then you say, I'm dealing with that all within that fee, and they will be so pleased. It is easier as an unincorporated person to get a more generous regime for motor expenses. As John said in his speech that you... Yes. Of course, have flat rate expenses, don't you, that you can put through mileage. Or what you normally do quite often for unincorporated business is you put all the expenses through the business and you say, add back private use, say what, 20%? Basically, if you're anywhere sort of out in, you know, in rural Tania, a private use add back of 20% is the most you'll be looking for. Probably if you've got an unincorporated business in the middle of London, you might, you know, it may not be as...
Yep.
But even then, you're not going to get an ad back, are you? More than half, I would have thought. Once you become a limited company, you have to do things properly.
What's the time at the moment?
And you have to keep mileage logs. And it's amazing how 80% businesses can plummet so much just by incorporating. And so in terms of motor expenses, that is one of the big problems. Avoiding PLMDs, if you stay unincorporated, that is good move. PLMDs have got to be the worst form there is out there in the system. And if the OTS could get P11Ds abolished, that would be a great risk. So these are advantages of being unincorporated. There may well be industry reasons why you want to stay unincorporated. For example, farmers, if you want to claim averaging relief, this is where farmers, you know, add their profits, divide by two, and to take into account fluctuating profits to avoid higher rates of tax. They could only do that if the farm is operated as an unincorporated business as opposed to a limited company. Or similarly, you may say, well, one of the other reasons, is there any point staying unincorporated because of the IR 35 condition? What is the point of incorporating if you're going to be caught by the revenues test on IR 35? Well, actually, what you're doing in that case is you are, if you incorporate, you are shifting the burden to yourself, because if you are unincorporated and you would have been caught by IR 35 if you'd formed your own limited company, then the people who are paying you should have been treating you as an employee as well. And so one advantage of being unincorporated is you can't be caught by R35, the person who pays you, you can, which is why a lot of companies won't pay unincorporated people. You may want VAT threshold issues if you've got an unincorporated and a limited company or trying to do business splitting. Big advantage why professional practices such as accountants will remain unincorporated, because clients are always saying to that, well, if this is so great, why don't you incorporate? And the main reason, I think, is probably how you introduce new members. Because anybody can become a partner just by making them a partner, but they can't become a shareholder in the business, because if you give them shares in your limited company, they've got to pay tax, haven't they? It may not be very much tax if you're giving them a 5% share in the company by the time you use share valuation techniques. It's not going to be too much of a problem. But introducing new members is certainly a main reason why firms stay as unincorporated. And then we have that client. There are those clients that thou shalt not incorporate. We know who they are. It is far easier to debit drawings than a director's current account. If you debit director's current account with a Tesco shopping bill, you've got to clear it somehow, somewhere. If you debit drawings, nobody cares. You may have an overdrawn capital account at the end of the day, but that's absolutely fine. So, and I actually think those clients should have it stamped on their forehead in case they meet one of your colleagues by mistake who goes ahead and incorporate them. But a word of professional warning, if you have got a client that you've allocated as a do not incorporate client, do make sure you've written a file note to say why. Now, do not write because the client's thick. I mean, that's... Well, you can do if you like, but basically, one of the key points that you're actually getting in terms of suing accounts is there's quite a good industry of actually suing the former accountant. So if you've not incorporated your client, and he goes or she goes to another firm of accountants who decide to incorporate that person, and says at the same time, look, you're going to be £2,011 better off on your profits of £30,000, and you could have been for the last 6 or 7 years, why don't we sue the former accountant? And therefore, you've got to say why you didn't incorporate. Now, the answer is usually something along the line, because having discussed it fully with the client, we talked about the pros and cons and decided that the advantage was to stay as unincorporated because it was easier to administer. And if the client is as thick as we're making him out to be, he won't know whether you had that meeting or not. So that's perfectly okay. But you do have to be careful, because I have seen people actually do that. I mean, we tend not to bother. But it is quite an easy way of losing your clients, because everybody goes down the golf club, have a limited company, and do very well. Against that, what are the actual business advantages as well of incorporation? Well, as we've seen, tax savings at every level of numbers, you will end up with tax savings by having a limited company. That's absolutely fine. But the big, big saving is income smoothing. It's quite a good way. I like the word income smoothing. It sort of gives you a bit of a cred, doesn't it? You only take tax funds out of the limited company that you need them. So if you think about the way that dividends work, if you are a basic rate taxpayer, you don't pay higher rate. And you're not a higher rate taxpayer, you pay no more tax on your dividends, do you? You declare the dividend to yourself, it comes with a basic rate tax credit, effectively. I know it's only 10%, but by the time you've done the work, it's effectively a basic rate tax credit. So if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you've got no further tax to pay on your dividends. So all of your limited companies should be declaring dividends to use their basic rate band every year. And then you say to the client, if you become a higher rate taxpayer, you have to pay... And it mathematically works out as 25% of the net dividend you pay. So your tax planning strategy is to keep, where possible, a husband and wife who are running a business, keeping both of them below the basic rate, being higher rate taxpayers. Then as the profits increase, you've got more levels to think about here. This new high income child benefit charge applies if one person in the family unit earns over 50,000. So your next planning scenario, if you've got taxpayers with limited companies with children, is you would take them up to make sure they're income at 50,000. And you will say to them, do you actually want to take more than 50,000? Whereas if they're a sole trader, or even a woman, if he's a sole trader and he earns £60,000 one year, 40 the next, his tax bill will be identical, more or less, but he would have paid back his child benefit charge. And if he's had two children, he would have paid back £1,752. And with four children, the marginal rate of tax between 50 and 60,000 is coming out of something like 73% now with National Insurance, which is what you would end up paying as a sole trader. Whereas if you're actually a limited company, you say to the chap, 40, 60, do you really need the 60? No. You just declare the enough dividend, so he only has 50 this year, and the 10 grand he can use next year when his profits are debt. And it's the income smoothing will go up a bit further, and you keep both spouses below 100,000. And that's the really big advantage of limited companies, is the ability to actually tax plan and take the exact tax consequences of what you are taking out of your business. You do have to be careful using the dividend scheme to make sure your business has earned profits to pay the dividend, because otherwise... We've had a client who went down the dividend route, made losses and losses and losses, has now got to repay all the dividends to the company because he paid illegal dividends. But let's assume your client's making money. Remuneration to spouse needs to be justified. Dividends to spouses, non-working spouses, whether they even know where the office is or not, doesn't make any difference. If they are a shareholder, they're entitled to receive dividends. The Arctic Systems case clearly says you can pay, providing they are proper ordinary shares with full rights, you can pay dividends to non-working spouses. So don't worry about it. Systems. The House of Lords made it absolutely clear it's perfectly okay. If you're going to start bringing preference shares in, certain alphabet shares I don't particularly like, but proper 100% Pucker ordinary shares, Arctic Systems says you can split 50-50. Not a problem at all. There are, again, there are just as for averaging for unincorporated farmers, if you want to claim research and development tax credits, so yeah, offset on your deductions throughout a year, you've got to have a limited company. And also, if you have a limited company, you can make more flexibility on pension contributions. Because don't forget, a limited company can pay up to £50,000, pension contributions of up to £50,000 per employee per year, whatever the remuneration level is of the director. There are. I saw one, I couldn't still believe people still writing these emails. I saw one just 2 weeks ago from a financial advisor who, we had a client using the dividend scheme, said, you will have to increase this year your remuneration if you wish to make pension contributions. Because you can only make pension contributions out of net relevant earnings, which includes earnings and not dividends. For limited companies, the limited company is making the contribution, then there is no, you haven't got to worry about net relevant earnings. It's, the limited company can pay up to 50,000 per employee, plus carry forwards if need be, per year. So these are all the really big advantages of incorporation. Disadvantages, you do need more discipline. And what I would actually say is, if the profits are going to be more than 30,000, I think the presumption should be that you operate as a limited company.
Well, no, and
now notice I only use the word presumption, not that thou shall.
Yeah,
because there are, you may well be that client, it may well be a farmer, there may be other reasons outside tax why you don't want to do that. But I think you really should, in your mind's eye, start with that and then prove to yourself why you're not doing that. That's the limit that we with. So we have in our office, because we've still got partners from the dark ages who tell me that this dividend scheme will never catch on. I've actually made it a mandatory condition on every file of an unincorporated or partner where profits are over 30,000. That he has to actually now explain why that business isn't incorporated. And I think that's good practice. But you don't, it has to be a presumption, but it is not automatic. What is doing the rounds at the moment is almost this year's fashion accessory in terms of tax planning is the hybrid scheme. How does this work? Well, you have two people operating as an unincorporated people in business. And it can work with one person, I've done it as two. They operate as their LLP or partnership. It doesn't matter whether it's an LLP or partnership. So they're operating as self-employed. They would like to go down the, have their limited company, but they've got these great big expensive cars that they want to claim their self-employment deduction on. There are other things they might quite fancy to put through as a self-employed without the P11D implications. So what they do now is they form a limited company and they make the limited company a partner in the business. So in this case here, they've started off, they each own 50% of the LLP. What have they done afterwards? Well, between them, the two little happy individuals there, they own 20% of the LLP, but they have formed a company, and the company owns the remaining 80% of the LLP. So therefore, if you want to, 80% of your profits can go to the limited company. So you're paying less Class 4 National Insurance because you've only got 20% of the profits going through the sole trader. The rest of it sits in the company and you can use dividends to extract it. So it's getting the best of both worlds. It doesn't have to be 80-20, it could be any ratio you want. So the concept of having corporate partners in a partnership for tax planning purposes works very well. And it still gives you the opportunity if you want to add three people. Well, you want to add somebody else in, you might be adding the LLP, and then it's up to them if they want to take the tax cost of going into the limited company. The advantages of it? Well, the big advantage is you can keep the motor cars in the LLP or the partnership. So they're not taxed for having company cars. You have to make sure in the partnership agreement that it says that each partner or each unincorporated partner, i.e. the two individuals, shall be entitled to have a car for their business use of the partnership to avoid it being by virtue of their limited company. But it gives you the option of using dividends from the companies, and it gives you the option of income shifting. You might not want to make your spouses actual partners in the business, but you may be happy for them to be joint shareholders with you in the limited company. So you've got an opportunity of using some of the income shifting, which is where you're actually transferring income to spouses. Obviously, you've got the income smoothing. So effectively, what you're doing is the retained profits you're using in the business. If it's an unincorporated business, because you pay tax on what you earn, if you want to keep money in the business, it's after paying the 40% tax, isn't it? Or after paying the 50% tax in the big cases. In a limited company, if you don't take the money out because you want to leave it in the business, you only pay corporation tax of 20%. And so it's much cheaper to keep retained profits in a limited company for use in the business. There are disadvantages. I mean, obviously, you're now, you know, one moment you were just running a partnership, now you're running a partnership in a limited company. So yes, it will cost more, but the savings will usually outweigh the cost. If you're doing this with a firm of accountants, you've got regulatory issues, because the limited company will, if you're doing it, say, will have to register with the Institute of Chartered Accountants. The partnership will have to register with the Chartered Accountants. The two directors will have to register. We tried something similar with my own firm, and the whole first year's tax savings went to the Institute of Chartered Accountants in regulatory fees. But and you've also got to be careful how you're dealing with the agreement, because the agreement, you know, once you start bringing corporate partners in, I mean, if you have a pure corporate partners, into some people, I've seen them where they have pure corporate partners, and then they have a partnership agreement which deals with partners going on maternity leave. Well, you know, corporate partners do not get pregnant. It's corporate partners do not go on holiday. So, and also what happens when you leave? Because if you've got pure corporate partners, so you haven't gone the hybrid scheme, you've gone down the pure corporate partners scheme, what happens when you leave? Any partnership agreement will say when a partner leaves, he cannot compete. Well, if a corporate partner leaves, the individual directors are still free to compete wherever they like. So you do need a bit of thought once you start bringing corporate partners into the agreement. But it can be done. Is it provocative? Yes. Does that mean it can't be done? No. So you can do it, but yes, it is provocative. And one of the other things, that if you do have a partnership or an LLP with corporate partners, you cannot get an annual investment allowance. Because there are no annual investment allowances for any partnership that has a corporate partner. However, leading us on to capital allowances, do we care about annual investment allowances anymore? Because there are new rules came in at the beginning of April for capital allowances. They came in on the 1st of April 2012 for companies and the 6th of April 2012 for partners and for unincorporated businesses. And the main change is the reduction in the annual investment allowance. So a reminder that what the annual investment allowance is. The annual investment allowance is the amount you can claim in the year of acquisition of an asset for your business. So if you buy computers for your business, you could have written off the first 100,000 you spend a year against tax. So it includes computers, it includes vans, it includes air conditioning, it includes basically any asset you buy for your business with the exception of motor vehicles. Motor vehicles did not qualify for annual investment allowance and still don't. What changed on the 1st of April 2012? Well, what changed on the 1st of April 2012 for companies was the limit went down from 100,000 to 25,000. Now, I was reading a capital allowances case recently where Wetherspoons had put a test case through, and they'd actually claimed 35 million capital allowances in a year. So they probably aren't affected too much by the reduction. But there are plenty of small businesses who say if you buy two vans will cost you possibly more than 25,000. You know, a van and a decent file server will cost you 25,000. So small businesses will be being hit now by the 25,000. The writing down allowances are also being reduced from the main pool from 20% to 18%, and for the small rate special rate pool from 10% down to 8%. Now, if you're actually spending 35 million on capital allowances, a reduction of 2% in your writing down allowance does cost you a lot of money. And effectively, this whole capital allowances regime is what's paying for half of the corporation tax reductions that we've had. Okay. So the fact that corporation tax has gone down from 26 to 24, half of it's being paid by the bank levy, and half of it's being paid by firms like Wetherspoons claiming less capital allowances. But don't just think of these as terms of numbers, because what we're talking about here is the tax challenges for the small business. It's what do these actually mean when you actually go and look at it in the business context? Obviously, there are transitional rules. What they've actually said, well, if you've got a year end of the 30th of June, part of your capital allowances will be at 100,000, part of it will be at 25,000, and therefore your capital allowances for the year will be 81,250. We all would have assumed that that makes a lot of sense. But what they actually did to not simplify matters, well, they also introduced a post 1st of April limit and said the most that you can have in your year at all is 81,250. However, of that 81,250, only 6,250 of it, in that case, could be spent after the 1st of April. So when we're looking at a client's maximum AIA in the current year, the transitional year, we've got two columns. The total maximum for their accounting period is what's on the left. Their maximum after the 31st of March is their spend on that is on the right. Can't do any planning about that now because we've gone past the 31st of March, so therefore we're stuck with it. But if you are in practice, what you can save yourself is the embarrassment of giving your client wrong advice. So if you've got a client with an October year end who phones you up in September and says, I understand I've got 56,250 AIA this year, can I go out, is that correct? If you say yes, you're technically correct. But if he goes out and spends £56,000 in October, he's going to be very, very disappointed because the most he can spend after April was £14,583. So we can't do any more planning for that, but you've got to be aware of it when you're actually telling clients what their allowances are until we get up to March 2013, when obviously it becomes £25,000 for everyone. But look at the business impact of it. This is a company that has bought a new third-hand combine harvester. They probably haven't bought one for at least 3 years, so they need a new one. It's £80,000. They bought the combine harvester. The company on the left, now, if they'd bought it on Saturday, the 31st of March 2012, they'd have spent their £80,000 on their combine. And that would have qualified for their AIA of £80,000. And therefore, in that first year when they're doing their April year end, they would have tax deduction capital allowances £80,000. But they didn't. They went to watch the football instead and went out and bought the combine on Sunday, the 1st of April. Result of which, he gets an AIA of 2,083, being the maximum he can spend after the 1st of April on his combine. Gets quite generous WDA, but the first year, therefore, in their tax comp, he's got £18,000 worth of capital allowances as opposed to 80. Then the following year, he writes it down at 18% because that's the new writing down rate. So as you can see, 4 years into it, so by April 2014, he's only just written, after 4 years, he's only written the cost off half of the value of that. And as you can see, once you're into the writing down allowance regime, now you might have thought to stimulate the economy, the government might want to encourage people to buy assets and give them generous AIAs, but it's not happening. So you've got to think about this when you're talking to your clients about their business decisions. What about the special rate pool? Well, what goes in the special rate pool? Remind ourselves what goes in there. If any expenditure on integral features that are above your annual, so anything like air conditioning above 25,000 will go into the special rate pool. Cars with a CO2 emission of over 160 go into the special rate pool. So these are company cars. And from April 2013, that drops to 130 CO2. So that's for cars. If the car's in the special rate pool now, that's fine. It's for new cars from April 2013. So what do you get in that case? Well, after 1 year, you're entitled, aren't you, to write off 8% of your car against tax. By year four, you've written off a whole 28% of that car against tax. The car in year four will probably be worth 25%. You've only written off 28%. After 9 years, you are, for tax purposes, able to write off half your car against tax. Year 17, you can write off three quarters of the value of the car. And in fact, by year 36, 95% of your car has now been written off against tax. don't bother to phone me and tell me you've done it. I'm not interested. I'll be sort of under. Not good. Yeah. And don't forget, once it's in, it can never come out. It's no good the client coming to you, you doing this computation, you saying, oh my God, what have you done? Go and buy it personally, take it out of the company. Because all that happens if you take it out of the company is the sale proceeds go in there and you get even less allowances. Because there's no balancing allowances anymore. The only time that you actually get a balancing allowance on a capital allowances pool, there's two occasions. One, when you cease to trade. Or two, when the figure gets down below 1,000. The fact you've got no assets because you've sold the only car that you ever stupidly put in that pool is not a reason for a balancing allowance. So don't do it. What can you do about the 8%? Well, what you can do is cars, I think you've got to be looking back at contract hire. I mean, the leasing companies know about this. There'll be more. Yeah, there is an ad back. If you lease a car with a special above 160, you have to have a 15% ad back. But it may be better to have a 15% ad back than not claim tax relief on the depreciation at all. So I think if you are having company cars and they are going to be above 130 COT, I think you want to be looking at contract hire. Obviously, cars that are held in an unincorporated business, you do get balancing allowances on, because any asset that has a private use will get you will go in its own pool, and therefore you can get a balancing allowance if you sell it. And the other thing which I think we now need to look at is to make these short life asset elections. Because if we're going to make short life asset elections, this is not new legislation. This has been around for many, many years. But we've never worried about it, have we? Because we don't need to worry about WDAs, because we've all had these cars. Oh, sorry, not cars. We've all had these assets that we've been claiming 100% AIA on, haven't we? We've been buying our combines for 80,000, so we don't care that we could do a short life asset election. We've been buying computers for 20,000. We don't care because we've been claiming AIA. Now we're not going to be able to get the AIA. We may want to be claiming a short life asset. And what you do is, when you're doing your capital allowances computation, you make an election. If you make an election, it goes into a single asset pool, which is a tremendous contradiction, but it does. That's what the revenue called it, a single asset pool. And then you carry on as if you would do effectively the same as an unincorporated business with a car. You follow it, it keeps itself, and if you actually get rid of the asset within 8 years, you can get a balancing allowance. How do you make the election? If it's I've no idea actually, but my guess is, I'm only the theory man. Now, the two ways I would make the election is, if you are a limited company and you're doing this, you're submitting the corporation tax computation anyway. So on the capital allowances computation, you would say, election made under whatever section number it is, and the revenue would see it. If you are doing it for a sole trade or unincorporated business, then they don't actually see the capital allowances computation, do they? They just see one figure. I think you go onto the white space note on the tax return and write on the white space, short life asset election made in respect of, and define what asset is you've actually made the short life asset election. You can elect for a group of assets to go into a single asset pool. What do we mean by this? Well, let's say you are a company, and it's quite a common policy that each year will replace one quarter of the computers that you've got on a four-year basis. Quite common practice for a lot of businesses. You know, right, we've got 40 computers. Rather than buying 40 computers at once, we think each computer will last 4 years. Therefore, once every 4 years, we will replace 10 computers. You can actually make an election for those 10 computers as if you only bought them for one. So you can say, instead of making an election in respect of laptop A and laptop B and laptop C and laptop DD and laptop EE, you can say all computers bought in that year. And you can also therefore justify scrapping those computers. So if in the 4 years' time you haven't actually sold them, but you know you've scrapped them because you've replaced them, under short life asset election rules, that counts as a disposal, and you can actually put a balancing allowance in to say, yep, we've scrapped these therefore we don't need them anymore. So what do you make a short life asset election on? You can't do it on cars, but you do it on basically any asset that you're buying if you're spending more than $25,000 on your AIA. Unless you think that you're going to be able to sell it for more than the government have allowed you, 18% depreciation a year. So they're going to be a lot more prevalent than they ever were. Nothing new, just we've never used them. If after 8 years you've still got it, the thing goes back into its own pool anyway, goes back into the main pool anyway, so you can't really lose. I'm going to finish the last quarter now on capital gains tax in terms of business structure, because, as I said, the time to plan for disposals is now. And what we're looking for is that from the 23rd of June 2010, gains qualifying for entrepreneurial relief at 10%, whereas other gains are going to be at 18% or 28%. What it actually says in the legislation, it says the rate of capital gains tax shall be 18%, unless you are a higher rate taxpayer, in which case it will be 28%. And trust the 28%. Now, what's happened with this slide is I've created a bit of confusion because I've copied it straight off what the revenue call out, which is where I say you have a one-off lifetime allowance. You'll probably find it easier if you actually scrubbed out the word one-off. Because the only reason it's a one-off lifetime allowance is because you only actually have one life. Don't think for one moment you have to make your entrepreneur relief gain in one go. You can make your entrepreneur relief gains over lots of disposals over many, many tax years. So it is not really it's a one-off lifetime allowance, but it applies throughout your life. And as you can see, that since 6th of April 2011, the limit, the entrepreneur's relief limit, is 10 million. So you can make 10 million gains and qualify for entrepreneur's relief. And I'm going to make a guess here. I am going to guess that nobody in this room has used their entrepreneur's relief allowance up. Because I suspect if you had made a gain of 10 million, you wouldn't be sitting here on a Friday night afternoon listening to me. Clearly, if you're going to float Facebook and you own Facebook, you're going to use your 10 million. It's going to be nothing, is it? But the limit went up and up and up. What a load of rubbish, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. The tax impact assessment on it going up from 5 million to 10 million says this will not affect hardly anybody. It says the 5 million limit is currently used 2/3 by males and 1/3 by females. This is not expected to change when it goes up to 10 million, primarily because no one was using the 5 million anyway. But it's now a very, very generous 10 million relief each. So you can each go make a gain, 10 million, and only pay capital gains tax at 10% on it. So it is therefore vitally important when we're advising our clients to make sure we get entrepreneurs relief. So we need to make sure they have qualifying assets. So if they are a sole trader or a partnership, they will get they will get entrepreneurs relief if they make a material disposal of business assets. So they have to sell their business to qualify for entrepreneurs relief. Or the bit at the bottom, which is slightly more long-winded, and they have to have owned it for a year, by the way. The bit at the bottom, the three-year bit, says sometimes you may not sell your business, you may just cease. So if you actually cease, providing you'd held the assets for a year before you cease, you get 3 years to sell it, and you can still get entrepreneurs relief. So if you've got a property that you're operating your business from, if you sell your business and sell your property, that's fine. If you don't sell your business, you just cease to trade, you've got 3 years to sell that property you used for business to get entrepreneurs relief. Or if you've got shares in your qualifying company, providing you've held those shares for a year, and you are an individual who owns 5% and is a director or employee of the company, they're qualifying assets that we want to get. Or again, your company ceases to trade, you've got 3 years to dispose of your shares. So for it to be your personal company, you've got to own 5%. And you must actually work for the company, but you can work for the company for as little as you like. It has to be a trading company, and if you go back to the old taper relief rules, it's an 80-20 company. What that means is at least 80% of the company's assets, management time, profitability must relate to trading income, not investment income. Trustees can qualify for entrepreneurs' relief, providing you have a life tenant of the trust, so somebody has a right to the trust assets, and that individual also qualifies. So that's the trustees we'll get at. But where we need to do is to look at the planning scenario. Because if you look at this scenario here of a company with these various shareholders, and this company goes to sell, none of those people will get entrepreneurs' relief. Mr. F is the founder shareholder. He has retired from the business, has nothing to do with it. He owns 26% of the company. He is no longer an employee. He is no longer a director of the company. He does not get entrepreneurs' relief. Mrs. D, his daughter, she stays at home. She's not a director or anything, whatever it is. So therefore, she doesn't get entrepreneurs' relief. Mr. D, the husband of Mrs. D, he actually works for the company. He doesn't get entrepreneurs' relief because he's only got 4%, so he doesn't get the minimum 5% shareholding. The trustees don't get it, even though they own over half the company. Why don't they get it? Because it's Mrs. D's trust, and Mrs. D doesn't get it, so therefore the trustees don't get it. And these two employees don't get it, even though they own 9% of the business. Because there's two of them, so you have to divide by two, so they only get 4.5% each, which is below 5%. Okay, contrived. Also contrived, but also very, very easy to solve. Mr. F, stick him on the payroll then. Put him back on the payroll, give him £5,000 a year. Still doesn't have to go to the property, just make him a £5,000 a year because we're employing him for his vast experience in the business. And he will get entrepreneurs' relief. Mrs. D, make her the company secretary. We know we don't need a company secretary anymore. It doesn't matter whether you need one. There's no question of being need here. Mrs. D can be company secretary. She's got no risk of being a company director. She will then get entrepreneurs' relief. Mr. D, well, he can either give 4% to his wife and therefore she will qualify, or he can persuade her to give him 1% and then she will qualify. So you could do something with those two holdings, get them to 5%. Once you've got Mrs. D, because just by making her the company secretary, the trust then qualifies because Mrs. D qualifies. And Mr. and Mrs. E, well, I'm afraid Mrs. E would just have to cross her name off and it just have to be owned by Mr. E because he works for the company. So very, very simple, very structured. But I saw a case very, very recently where people were issuing shares to employees under share option schemes. And it was taking certain of these shareholders down below 5% limits. And therefore, do watch what's actually happening. What happens in this case, Nick and Eddie, they're partners in a firm of accountants based in Bristol. They sell their property and rent offices. So they trade for a business and they sell. Do they get entrepreneurs' relief? No, they don't. Why don't they get entrepreneurs' relief? The reason why they don't get entrepreneurs' relief is they haven't sold their business, have they? They have sold an asset used in business. They have sold the property. Because it says in the question, they have sold the property and moved elsewhere in Bristol. Therefore, they don't get entrepreneurs' relief. Go back to taper relief days, they would have got taper relief. But they will not get entrepreneurs' relief because they haven't sold their business. This is the retirement relief case. What they did when entrepreneurs' relief came in, they picked up the retirement relief legislation and changed the name, did find and replace, and took it to entrepreneurs' relief. To get retirement relief, for those of you who can't remember retirement relief, what it basically said was if you made a disposal and you were over 50, then you didn't pay any capital gains tax on the first 250,000. All they've done is they've deleted that bit and now said you have to be a shareholder. This is still my most embarrassing thing I ever did in tax. I acted for two clients, one called Shirley, one called Kate. It was in the days of retirement relief. Shirley phoned me up and said, Barry, I'm selling our business. We're selling it for $150,000. How much CGT will I pay? I said, Shirley, don't worry, you're over 50. There's no tax to pay at all. She said, but Barry, I'm only 43. It's quarter past. It's quarter past the finish.
Yeah.
I said, oh, right. And then she said, and before you make the same mistake again, Kate is under 50 as well. And I just stupidly said, yes, I could tell. Was I glad to see retirement relief abolished? So I always remember retirement relief. I was always, never have I been so glad to sell a client. Oh, she gave me grief. So the question there is, farmer sells 50 land, acres of land for housing but keeps 800 acres. Won't be disposable because it'll be deemed, and this was the McGregor Aycock case, no, he'd sold part of the land, he hadn't sold the business. If it was the 50 acres was used for grazing and the farmer ceases his livestock operation, then I think he probably may well get entrepreneur's relief because he has effectively ceased the operation relating to the livestock. He could always cease to operate by getting rid of his 50 shares, 50 acres of land, and then ceasing to trade by transferring the farmland to a limited company, therefore guaranteeing a cessation of trade. And the first EIR case helps him. M. Gilbert, it's a case, 2012 case, I don't think it's being appealed against yet, I'm not sure. Basically, this chap put his whole business up for sale. From nine, there were separate distinct businesses, and he couldn't sell nine of them, but he managed to sell one part of the business. And he claimed entrepreneur's relief on the grounds he had ceased to trade that part of the business that he sold. And the revenue said no, and it went to the first tier tribunal who said yes, it did, because it disposed of that part of the business. Just finish with one very small problem we now have with entrepreneur's relief. Reason being, because this was a problem with retirement relief, is that if you own the property personally, but a full market rent is paid by your company, because if you have a disposal, if you sell an asset at the same time as you sell your shares, that will qualify, unless your company has been paying rent. If your company pays a full rent to you, you will not get entrepreneur's relief if you sell your property at the same time as you sell your shares. Because that's what the rules were in retirement relief, which have just been dusted down. Two ways round it. Well, here's a problem, you see. This is an example here of the problem. What you have to do is you have to look at the rent and say, you can ignore any rent that's paid before 2008, but in this example here, since 2008, William has received a full rent from the company, and therefore, part of the gain does not qualify for entrepreneur's relief. How do you get around it? There's two ways of getting around it. If you go in a partnership, go back to the way we used to do things in the retirement relief day. If you've got a partner who owns a property, don't let the partnership pay rent for the property. Give him an extra slug of profits in lieu of rent. Because if you allow him a first share of profits equivalent to what you would have paid him as rent, you're not renting the property, are you? And it would have qualified, and it will then qualify for entrepreneur's relief. And if you've got a limited company, why does your limited company pay rent? Well, the reason quite often why the limited company pays rent is that the director has borrowed the money personally. So the director has borrowed the money personally to buy the property to be used by the company. He wants to get tax relief on the interest, so therefore needs a rental income from the company to claim tax relief on the interest. So why not fix the rent to equal the same as the interest? What does that do? Well, what you do in this case, we're saying that the client only wants £6,000 worth. He's paying £6,000 worth of interest, therefore he only needs £6,000 worth of rent from the company. But the market rent is clearly £60,000. So therefore, by just doing that, it means that when he comes to sell, 90% of the gain still qualifies for entrepreneur's relief and only 10% doesn't. So we just need to think when we're operating, and that's why we need to think now about it. It's no good thinking, I'm going to sell next year, and you've had a company paying a rent for the last 10 years, because that's too late.
Right, Barry, I'm going to have to cut in now.
Would you like to cut it? I'll tell you what, just to show how well I am, what, look at that. Seamless, look at that.
Hear that? Oh, yeah. So, can we thank Barry for what was really a practical, relevant tax planning area? It's sort of bang on our AAT type stuff, so thank you very much, Barry. Now, we've got a quick round of musical chairs. I should imagine Barry will hang around outside for a few minutes. John Whiting is still out there if you want to have a chat with him. If you want coffees and you're coming back in this room, then the coffee cups are just outside of here. If you're going to a different room, there will be coffees outside the room you're going to. So we've got 5 minutes. Thank you, mate.